Hello and welcome to Comic Talk Today for Wednesday, October 24th, 2018, New Comic Book Day. Hell yeah. I'm actually home. As I said yesterday, I'm off all week on vacation. I had a little surgical procedure yesterday. Everything's good. No need to worry. Relax, guys. I'm fine. Obviously, I'm fine. I'm recording. But, yeah, this is the episode of the week I like to call Top of the Pile, in which I look at some of my favorite comics from last week's New Comic Book Day. And yeah, I'm a little late this week. I usually do this like on Mondays, but you know what? Things get hectic. I can't help it. But I'm recording it today. I've got six books that I want to talk about. And I found last week kind of curious. And I don't know if anybody else noticed anything like this. Maybe it was just me. But normally I read, about 20, 25 books a week, roughly. For some reason, last week felt a much, much smaller week. I try to look at my pull list. I think I only had like 13 or 14 books, which is definitely lower. So I'm only doing six books today. But let me know if you find that curious. Because, I mean, if it was a fifth week, I'd understand, right? But it wasn't a fifth week. So I don't know. Maybe it's just the state of mind that I'm in. Who knows? Anyways, let's talk about some comics. Let's kick off talking about Rick Grayson. Nightwing number 51 is the first book that I want to talk about. This is written by Scott Lobdell with help from Fabian Nicieza. We've got art by Travis Moore and Gary Brown. I do love some Gary Brown, so I'm glad he's in here. Colors by Hi Fry and Nick Filardi. Letters by Darren Bennett. So I talked about this issue a little bit on yesterday's episode. That's why I titled it, Who the Hell is Rick Grayson? And finally, we're talking about this book. So if you haven't been reading Nightwing, if you haven't been reading the Batman comics, there may be spoilers as to what's happening here, but I hope you stick with me. After the events of, I guess, Batman 55, there's a whole new direction going for Nightwing. And I know this has been talked about in a bunch of comic book websites. There's been podcasts that have talked about it. I haven't really talked about it too much, just a little bit, not too much. And from my understanding, the guys over at the Absolute DC podcast will be talking about it on their episode tomorrow. So check that out. Ronnie and Aaron do a great job over there. And I'm sure Aaron is going to be much angrier about this Rick Grayson than I am. Because, to me it's a little upsetting, but it's maybe not a huge deal. I mean, I kind of understand what's happening. Let me get to that a little bit later. I'll recap the story a little bit. So if you haven't been following the books, spoiler alert. All right, are you back? Dick Grayson was shot in the head by the KG Beast in Batman 55, I believe it was. And I'm finally caught up on that book. I quit at 54 because I like to get some of those backed up a little bit. I feel like they read much better when I do multiple issues at once. So I am caught up all the way through 57 right now. And I think it was an interesting story, a good issue. I like the fact that they're trying to do new things with Dick Grayson. And of course, there's been a change of pace for the book because we have a new writer coming on board. Scott Lobdell's taking over this book after the last issue, which is actually kind of weird, right? Because issue 50 had the original writer, Ben Percy, if I'm not mistaken. He was writing the book and did partial writing duties on 50. Now we've got Lobdell taking over 51. Now, I do like Lobdell. As you guys know, I love Red Hood and the Outlaws, or I guess Red Hood Outlaw is what it's called now, who knows. But I love that book. I think it's absolutely brilliant. Even this new direction that they're going in, I think is absolutely fantastic. So, I was eagerly anticipating this new Nightwing arc. And I think so far it's kind of interesting. There's certain callbacks to other things that make the story not really feel fresh and new. I think the take overall could be really interesting. Basically, after the events of Batman 55, so Dick got shot, he goes to Bloodhaven, he pretty much has memory loss. He's lost about 15 years of his memories, so from the way that the book plays out, it seems like he's forgotten things from the time of his parents' death until fairly recently, within the last, like couple of weeks. So basically, he has no recollection of him being Nightwing or being part of the Bat family, any of that stuff. At least not consciously. Subconsciously, there may be some other things going on. I'll get to that in a few. But we do see some flashbacks, right, of him with his parents. He kind of knows who Alfred is because Alfred does show up in issue 51 of Nightwing. And by the way, there is not enough love for Alfred from the fans, from creators, from anybody. Alfred is the glue that binds, folks. The glue that binds. If Alfred was not around, I'm not sure how well the Bat family would work. Now, Batman would work fine by himself, you know, Batgirl fine by herself. Everybody would be fine on their own. But in terms of keeping a cohesiveness into the Batman family, without Alfred, I don't know if that would work. I'll be perfectly honest. And if you're not sure what I'm talking about, then read this issue, Nightwing 51, and you'll kind of understand. Because the things that Alfred says to Dick, the way he handles Dick, absolutely brilliant. He is definitely like the, you know, Bruce Wayne is always like the father figure. Alfred is the wise grandpa. And I love it. I love it. I wish we get an Alfred book. I think that'd be fun. I know that, you know, they're working on that Alfred TV show. I think that'll be interesting to see. I like the way that Gotham has taken on Alfred. I think that's also really interesting. But you don't get a whole, or maybe not enough of that in the comics. I want to see more of that. Anyway, so Dick has lost his memory. So he's in Bloodhaven. Of course, he's very familiar with Bloodhaven, but because of his memory loss, he has to get reacquainted with how the city works. He takes up a job as a cab driver, which, okay, that's fine. According to him, part of the reason he's taking up this job is to kind of remember the way the streets are laid out and how the city works and all that. I can understand that. But to be honest, he has no interest in being Dick Grayson anymore, in being Nightwing anymore. In fact, he doubts the fact that some of his friends and coworkers even care about who he is. All they care about is Dick Grayson. And to be honest, that's a little unfair. I understand why it's been written this way, but it's a little unfair because what's the difference? It's the same person. So of course they love Dick Grayson. That's who they've known their entire lives. And he just feels no connection to Dick and as a result has opted to go by the name of Rick Grayson. And, man, I don't know how I feel about that. Like, if your name is Rick, then I apologize. But, it doesn't work for me having him be named Rick Grayson. None of it's because I'm used to reading 80 years worth of Dick Grayson. But what's wrong with just keeping him named Dick Grayson? I mean, I understand he's trying to kind of create this new entity, this new identity, trying to find out who he is, who he wants to be. But we haven't really seen that from other characters, right? I mean, they've all kind of retained their names. I mean, look at Jason Todd right now. He's still Jason Todd. He's still the Red Hood. I think the thing is Dick maybe wants to, maybe Dick feels like he needs to forge his own identity. And that's the thing that is kind of a recurring thing, right? Because we got that way back in the day when he decided, I don't want to be under Batman's shadow anymore. I'm not going to be Robin anymore. I want to be my own man. I'm going to be Nightwing. But guess what? He was still Dick Grayson. So for me, this whole Rick thing doesn't work. I mean, it definitely feels like a cabbie name. And if your name is Rick, again, I apologize that I'm stereotyping the name Rick. But to me, Rick is a cab driver name, and I understand why he's a cabbie. But he's not who I want him to be. Because I personally love Dick Grayson. Now, he didn't make my top five characters yesterday, and that's fine. But he's definitely in the top 10. And he's one of, you know what? He is my favorite Batman. Okay, I'll just go there. He's my favorite Batman. He may not be my favorite Robin, but he's pretty close. He's maybe number two behind Tim Drake. I love Dick Grayson. I think he's a fantastic character. And I think this new direction that he's in doesn't feel like Dick at all. And maybe that's the point, and that's why he's going by Rick. But there's a lot to leave behind in terms of the way this character has worked. Even through all the evolutions and the iterations of Dick Grayson throughout the years, he still felt like Dick Grayson. And this Rick guy does not feel like Dick Grayson. However, I do trust in Scott Lobdell and Fabian Nicieza, so I hope that they know exactly where the story's going. And again, because of the amazing work that Scott Lobdell has put into Red Hood, I'm able to kind of leave behind some of my insecurities about where the story will end up leading. But I'm still unsure yet, at least as of right now. Maybe once we get through one whole arc, I'll feel a little bit better about it. But right now, I'm still a little weary of where we'll go. I do like the fact that we're going to have a new Nightwing, though. That seems to be the case. There's a police officer in Bloodhaven that finds Dick's like secret base of operations in Bloodhaven, and there's costumes there. So at the end of the issue, spoiler alert, he decides to take up one of the costumes, so he's going to become Nightwing. So that could be an interesting way to play out. You know, we've seen that. Who's doing that right now? The Spider-Man book is doing that a little bit, where Spider-Man has kind of become a separate entity from Peter Parker. Could be really interesting to explore things that way, but we'll see. We'll see. I don't think it worked as well when, for example, Commissioner Gordon took over Batman in Scott Snyder's run. I enjoyed it, but he didn't feel like Batman, right? And maybe this detective guy, because he is a detective, will feel a little bit more like Nightwing, but we'll see. I'm still not convinced yet. Not convinced yet. Overall, though, I did really enjoy the book. My one issue with this book is that I don't like Rick Grayson. He just seems like a douchebag character, honestly. And that hurts me a little bit because Dick is not that at all. So anyway, we'll see. I'm going to still give this a 4 out of 5. I think it was absolutely fantastic. The art's really well done. The writing's well done. Story's well paced. I love the little Alfred thing going on in here as well. So I look forward to reading the next of this. And, I hope you did too. So if I'm curious to know what people think about this new direction. If you're reading the book, let me know on Geekvine or at Geekvine on Twitter, and, yell at Comic Talk Today is the email address. Let's go from there on over to Captain Ginger number 1 from Ahoy Comics. This is written by Stuart Moore with pencils by June Brigman, inks by Roy Richardson, colors by Veronica Gandini. And letters by Richard Starkins and Jimmy Betancourt. Now, regular listeners know I'm really enjoying the output from Ahoy Comics. I haven't talked about High Heaven yet. I believe there's a new issue of High Heaven coming out this week. So I'll maybe bring that up on next week's Top of the Pile. But I'm really digging Ahoy Comics. Really, really digging it. They're doing interesting stuff. Really well-crafted stories. I love the amount of back matter in each of these issues, right? Because they're kind of like a magazine format, so there's some prose and stuff at the end of it. Really well done. I'm not going to talk about any of that stuff. I'm just going to concentrate on the main story of Captain Ginger. And this is kind of a quirky one. Really interesting choice that they would put out a book like this. But, you know, like I said, Ahoy does have a little stint of comedy thrown in there as well. And Captain Ginger is basically about a group of spacefaring cats. All right? So don't turn off the podcast yet. Let's just listen. Because it's actually really interesting. It's about a group of cats in the future who have become kind of anthropomorphic, right? They can stand on their hind legs. They're intelligent. They have language. And as we learn in this issue, humans are not around anymore. They don't call them humans. They call them feeders because, you know, humans feed cats. So I guess that makes sense. Humans are not around anymore. We learn a little bit through Captain Ginger's mom as to what may have happened. It seems like, you know, humanity has humanity has a great propensity to create weapons to kill each other, right? I mean, that's not a secret. It's a fact. And as it turns out, humanity created this weapon to help them in this war against, I guess, between warring factions. And aliens came down to Earth, invaded Earth. They stole the weapon, and they used the weapon to destroy all of humanity around the galaxy. So there are no more humans anymore. Somewhere along the way between all this stuff happening, it seems like animals gain consciousness, at least cats. My assumption is there will be some kind of genetic engineering or some kind of tech angle to this thing. Whether that gets explained or not, I'm not really sure, and I don't really care, because it doesn't really matter how they gain consciousness. You know, once we get to the fact that humanity's not around, and that kind of helps set up the bad guys, the aliens called the Lumen, everything else is kind of irrelevant. So Captain Ginger is the captain of the starship. When the issue opens up, they're fighting one of these Lumen spacecraft. They manage to escape through some comedic elements, especially Science Cat, who just throws up all the time. And they just kind of feel like it's because he's got anxiety. But as we learn a little bit later on, he's got a tumor. So, you know, there's the little play between the comedy and the drama stuff. And I think it's something that Ahoy does really well. Stuart Moore and Tom Peyer, they're, I think, absolutely brilliant writers. I think they really get what the comics medium's about. And of course they should, because they've both been in the industry for God knows how many decades, right? So it makes perfect sense. But they manage to escape, and they find this space station in the middle of space. They decide to go in there because they're having some issues with their AI that also helps make food and things like that. So they go to the space station, and there's rats everywhere. And so, of course, the cats go crazy because they're hungry, and they start feeding on the rats. And you get like a little Lord of the Flies moment in here where some of the cats decide to stay on the space station, led by kind of the second in command of the ship. Captain Ginger goes back to his ship, and there's basically mutiny, right? A lot of cats are going to the space station, and he doesn't know what to do. He goes to see his mom, who's an absolutely trash person or a trash cat. She's just humongous. She looks like Boba Fett in cat version, right? She's humongous. There's like cans of cat food just littered all over her room. All she does is watch TV all day and get served food by other cats. And, you know, Kevin's just like, hey, you know, these people have left me. What do I do? And she's like, you keep on forgetting that you're not a feeder, right? You're not a human. You're a cat. You need to think like a cat. The reason you were able to escape the Lumen attack is because you thought like a cat and not a feeder. So think like a cat and figure it out and quit being a baby about it. So he gets back in a suit, goes into the space station, and basically challenges his second in command to a duel in some way. So they start duking it out, and finally they both realize like they all need to be together. The only way for them to survive is to be together on the ship and trying to find a better place to be, right? Not, instead of just flying around, try to avoid these aliens every day of their lives. Good thing they do, because as they do and they start flying off into space, the Lumen come in and destroy the space station where all the cats were hanging out previously. And then the book ends with a transmission from apparently another group of cats that have been floating in space. We don't get to see them, but there's like a paw on the incoming transmission thing. So interesting stuff. I really enjoyed it. There's a lot of interesting commentary in here. You know, one thing I talk about this when I discuss Animosity, for example, not so much in this podcast, but on the Aftershock Central podcast that I do with Ronnie and Travis. Whenever we talk about Aftershock or Animosity, this comes up because, you know, you're able to tell certain types of stories dealing with human elements, but using animals in a much different way, right? Where the reader can kind of feel a little more distance from it because these aren't humans, they're animals, but you can tackle those human problems. It's like if you ever read like Animal Farm, for example, right? It's a commentary on like communist socialist, culture, but doesn't feel as personal because they're all just animals. And it's kind of the same way here with Captain Ginger. You know, if this story had been about humans out in space evading these aliens, it still would have been cool, but I don't think it would have worked as well as it did with this group of cats. And of course, there's like a ton of cat jokes, right? Like if you get in trouble, you get sent to the scratching post. So you have to like scratch yourself until you're allowed to leave. Like just weird stuff like that. And it really works. I'm loving the output from Ahoy Comics. And this is another one that I'll continue picking up. So Captain Ginger number one is going to be a 4 out of 5. All right, let's go on over to Marvel. And I've got two Marvel books I want to talk about. First one is Shuri number one, written by Nnedi Okorafor. Art by Leonardo Romero, colors by Jordi Belair, letters by Joe Sabino, and cover by Sam Pratt. Man, these covers, by the way, are awesome. My assumption is I don't know. Let me tell you, if these are painted, they are beautiful and very realistic. My assumption was that they were maybe like Photoshop photography, I don't know, but they are beautiful. Shuri number one. So, this is actually really interesting because, you know, I'm reading the Black Panther book, and I've been wondering how it is that we got to the place that we're in Black Panther. And if you're not reading Black Panther, it's out in space. Wakanda has, like, they basically colonized the galaxy. And I'm like, well, how the hell did we get here? And it seems to start here in Shuri number one, because as the book starts, Shuri is preparing a spaceship, the first spaceship from Wakanda. They're going to send, for some reason, Black Panther. Now, why you would send your leader on your first expedition is beyond me. And there's a couple of reasons for that, right? So number one, the technology is first generation, right? So I understand that Wakanda is extremely advanced, but, you know, there's something about first gen tech that you never want to completely trust it, right? Why not send like a group of explorers out into space? Why have to send your leader, your king into space as your first person? That I didn't understand. But other than that, I don't have any problems with this issue. So they're going to be sending, Black Panther out into space with a group of Wakandans. And so we get to learn a little bit about this mission, how the world is seeing Wakanda, as a result of the new space race. And Shuri is just being Shuri, right? She loves creating stuff. She has learned a lot from her death, in I think it was in World of Wakanda, where she died and she went to that other realm where the Wakandan ancestors are, gained a lot of knowledge, came back, and she's using that knowledge to create things. And the spaceship was one of those things she created. She's also got this like little cool, like rover thing. It's like a little ball that she can send to the market, so she can like kind of analyze where everything's at. And, it's got built-in tech, like a communicator. She builds herself some wings, because I guess she wants to fly. So she builds these awesome metal wings and, she's having a good time doing it. And, finally, as she's going through the market, she gets a message from her mom to meet her at the, Baobao tree. And so she goes and there's a group of women there. And we learn that, you know, throughout the centuries, whenever Wakanda's in trouble, it is a group of women that hit, that, you know, meet in secret, before like the Wakandan elders meet and try to figure out how to solve this issue. And so there's been a group of Wakandan women put in this group, and they're from all walks of life, right? Like there's like a high school student, there's a seamstress, the queen is there, and they need to figure out what they're gonna do now that Black Panther's not around. Because as it turns out, even though Shuri put all this tech in it to track the ship and to be able to communicate and all that, the ship has disappeared and they haven't heard from the ship in about 2 weeks. So they don't really know what's going on, and Wakanda has to have a leader. And so, of course, at the end of the issue, they say, hey, Shuri, we want you to become the Black Panther. And that's the overall of the issue. And it's fine. The plot is pretty straightforward. I think this is one of those series that, you know, you get a lot of good setup, but you're not really going to have the story kick off until probably the second and into the third issue. And that's pretty ballsy. That's pretty ballsy for a comic publisher to do that. But I think it really works with the story. And I think even through that, as simple as this first issue was, I thought it was really well done. Because there's something to me about Shuri that made the book really interesting. I don't know if it's her extremely positive attitude, but there's something about her that is just, it engrossed me in the story. And I really, really enjoyed it. I was extremely pleasantly surprised, because even though I was looking forward to this book, I wasn't sure if it would be something that would kind of hold my interest, but it really did. It really did. The artwork is something that I was a little weary of when I first opened the book, but I got used to it pretty quickly, and I think it's actually really well done. So I'm going to give Shuri a 4 out of 5 as well. I really dug it. Next up from Marvel is Marvel Zombie number 1. That's right. Marvel Zombie. Simon Garth. That Marvel Zombie. I love Simon Garth, by the way. So this is written by W. Maxwell Prince, who, of course, writes Ice Cream Man over Image, a book that I really love. Art by Stefano Raphael. Colors by Rochelle Rosenberg. Letters by Travis Lanham. And cover by Juan Ferreira. All right. So if you're familiar with the Marvel Zombies thing, this takes place in that time frame, right? So this is a kind of a what-if-y future story. In fact, I would have loved it if this had been part of the what-if line, right? So Marvel's doing those one-shots now. This almost feels like it could have been, I don't know, what-if Defenders, right? Because the Defenders are the team that we see in this book. And it's a different Defenders team. This Defenders team is comprised of Daredevil, who's the leader. We've got Misty Knight, Hawkeye, the girl Hawkeye. We've got Moon Girl. We've got, Sam Wilson, the Falcon, and there's a couple of kids in here as well. And I can't remember if they named who the kids were. But, so that's the Defenders. And basically the world has been overrun by zombies, and, it's up to the Defenders to fight the zombies and find a cure for the zombie virus. Alright, that's the basic setup. That's the basic setup. The story itself is actually really quite interesting. Really quite interesting. And I think one of the things that I love about really well-done zombie stories, and I'm going to tell you why in a few, but Simon Garth is, of course, the Marvel Zombie in the title. And if you're not familiar with Simon Garth, he's been around for forever. I think he came out in, like, I want to say mid-50s, maybe. If you've never read the Tales of Zombie that came out, I don't know if that was still Marvel. It may have been when they were still Atlas. But really fantastic stuff, created by Stan Lee. He's been worked on by a ton of other folks. I think Roy Thomas wrote him for a little while. Doug Mensch wrote him for a little while. It's just fantastic character from a particular era. You know what I'm saying? So Tales of the Zombie was like a early to mid 70s series. It lasted a couple of years, and you know, it's when horror was starting to become kind of big again, because when the Comics Code Authority came in, they kind of horror books basically disappeared until the 70s. And so this is kind of the resurgence of that kind of thing. And of course, Marvel in the 70s was really interesting, because that's when we start getting characters that we really know and love now, right? Like Iron Fist and Doctor Strange and those kind of things popped out from that era. Anyways, back to Marvel Zombie. The really cool thing about the way the story is told is that you have a couple of different narrators. And the main narrator is Simon Garth because he is a zombie. But unlike the other zombies in this book, he is self-aware, right? So he can't speak or anything like that because he's a zombie. He doesn't have that ability. But he does have the ability to think. And so he narrates a lot of the landscape. He narrates a lot about the people that he's meeting, about these different zombies around the city. And it looks like New York City because at the end it looks like Times Square. And we see some familiar characters, right? Like there's a Doc Ock zombie that shows up. There's a Wilson Fisk zombie that shows up. There's a Norman Osborn zombie that shows up. Really cool, well done, but they're not key characters. Like, they just show up in a panel and kind of disappear. But Simon is kind of really the main narrator. And he talks a little bit about, you know, the zombies and the infestation, how he's different from these other zombies. And, you know, the one thing about Simon Garth is he's got this pendant. And one of the kids is hanging out with the Defenders, finds the pendant, and as a result, when he brings them into the base, after the Defenders fight off hundreds of zombies, right? Oh, and Spider-Man's part of the Defenders as well. Forgot about him. And Black Widow. So after they fight off all these zombies, the kid comes back to Defenders headquarters with Simon Garth. And they're like, oh my God, it's a zombie. We've got to kill him. And Simon's like, no, don't kill me. But like, you know, he's thinking this whole thing because he can't speak. And, you know, he formed a connection with the kid because the kid also had this pendant. And as all this is happening, they learn that the pendant can control Simon. And part of the way that they want to get rid of the zombie infestation is to launch this necrobomb. And the necrobomb is basically like a radioactive nuclear bomb, but they don't have radioactive elements. Well, as it turns out, people in our blood have some radioactive elements, very minute amounts, but you know, they're going to use, somebody is going to volunteer to detonate this bomb with themselves as fuel. Now that they found Simon Garth, they're like, well, we can just put the strap on him, put the bomb on him, send him out to this group of zombies, because there's another sector of the city that has, you know, thousands of zombies. They're going to send him there, controlled by either the kid or one of them, and detonate the bomb using Simon's radioactive elements in his blood or flesh or whatever. And that'll kind of help him make the city a better place because there'll be thousands of less zombies. Well, of course, like, the kid doesn't want to do this. Simon doesn't really want to do this, although, I mean, I guess he kind of sort of agrees to it in some way. You know, he can't talk, but, you know, the kid's kind of upset about it. And Moon Girl's the one that created this thing. I love Moon Girl in here, by the way. I've never been a fan of Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, but I think the take on in this book is actually really interesting. She almost had like that Shuri vibe, right? Like, super smart, creating things, very young. And so she's the one that created this bomb. She straps it on. They kind of go through the process of how this is going to work out. The Defenders go out into the city and try to wrangle in all the zombies into one space, because the bomb, even though it's a nuclear bomb, doesn't have a giant reach, right? It's, you know, I think, as I said, like 3 or 4 city blocks. So, you know, all the Defenders are wrangling the zombies in. They start getting chewed up. They start getting killed and eaten. They're like, come on, Moon Girl, you know, blow up the bomb. And as she's about to send Simon Garth in there to do it, the little kid talks to her and he's like, hey, like, would you ever send your best friend to the death like this? And they have a little short conversation. I guess kind of Moon Girl changes her mind and takes the bomb off of Simon Garth. So all the Defenders are dead. They've all been eaten by zombies. And Moon Girl's like, look, I betrayed humanity, but I understand what you mean, because, you know, the friendship is the most important thing. And I could never do that kind of thing. So she goes off with Devil Dinosaur 2.0. DD 2.0 is what they call it. It's a giant robot dinosaur. Because apparently that's kind of how he gets to her, right? It seems like maybe she did send the original Devil Dinosaur into battle somehow, and Devil Dinosaur was killed. And so she created this giant robot Devil Dinosaur. And then the little kid and Simon Garth walk off into the distance, into the sunset, in a city that's obviously been obliterated. But I guess they can maybe live happily after. So really interesting stuff. You know, like I always say, the cool thing about really well done zombie movies is that it deals more with relationship between people and not so much the zombies, right? The zombies are an extraneous threat. that kind of puts people in certain situations. And that's the situation here. And as a result, I loved it. If you're a zombie fan, like, you're going to love the hell out of this. If you're expecting something a little more superhero-y, then you'll probably hate it. But that's not really who this book is for. I just thought it was brilliant. And W. Maxwell Prince, I think, is just a brilliant, brilliant horror writer. And I'm super happy to have him do some work over at Marvel. So this one's a 5 out of 5. You know what? I'll just go ahead and call it Pick of the Week. Marvel Zombie number 1 from Marvel Comics. On over to Image, we've got Exorcisters number 1. This is written by Ian Boothby with art by Giselle Lagasse. Colors by Peter Pantazis and letters by Taylor Esposito. I always got to do it. Sorry, guys. Sorry, Taylor. And this was actually kind of cool. I've been familiar with Giselle's work for quite a while. She's done work for the Die Kitty Die stuff, mostly covers, and I think there might have been a backup in there as well. And I know she was supposed to be at C2E2 a couple of years ago when I went and ended up being held at the border for, I don't know, some weird story. Like, she told them she was selling her work in the U.S., and they're like, oh, well, you don't have a work visa, so you can't sell your art in the U.S., and so she wasn't able to come. Anyways, this is a brand new book from Image Comics, and it's really interesting. So it follows these two sisters, hence the name Exorcisters, who deal in the paranormal. And as the book kicks off, we see that this girl is about to get married to a guy. Something happens, a devil pops out of nowhere, traps the guy in chains, takes him down to hell, and, you know, he's like, you're never going to see your love again because he owes me a favor. And we can assume, like, maybe he sold his soul or whatever to gain riches or become famous or whatever. So nobody believes her, right? Everybody just feels like he just left her at the altar, except the priest. He's like, well, maybe there's something a little different going on, right? I've dealt with the exorcists before. Why don't you call the Exorcisters? So they come in, they start analyzing, and it's kind of a detective story, right? So they go through all these things to figure out what the hell happened to the fiance, and they do a spell, go down into hell, and we meet some really weirdo demon monsters. I mean, the book's kind of funny, and Giselle's art style is kind of Archie-esque, so obviously it's a little more lighthearted. I love one of the demons, by the way. I can't remember his name, like Lord something. But they're going through hell, and they find this demon lord, and he's dressed in a little girl's outfit. He's having a tea party with, like, rabbits and some other demons or whatever. And as it turns out, like, it's a demon that tried to possess this little girl. And in order to finish his binding spell, he read it backwards. And as a result, instead of him taking over the girl's body, the little girl took over the demon's body. So it's actually a little girl inhabiting the demon. And I thought that was cool, right? Like the reverse possession thing. Anyways, after going through hell, they find out that the guy is not in hell. So he's got to be somewhere else. And they start doing some digging. And it turns out that the couple that was about to get married are real estate agents. And so they start looking through one of these houses that they can't apparently sell. And they find a fiance in there, right? And the girl's like, what the hell? What are you doing in this house? And there's a little demon that pops out of this other room. And so as it turns out, the fiance had some kind of issue with his wife-to-be. And he had this plot where he wanted to make a bunch of money. So he got in touch with this demon who feeds on sadness. So he faked his death so that his fiance would be extremely sad. The demon would feed on the sadness and give him money. Except now the girl was no longer sad. She was pissed when she found out the truth. So the demon made all the money disappear, so now he was broke. And yeah, that's kind of the end of the story. Well, the end of that story. We head back to this detective agency that the sisters have. One of them opens the door. There's a knock at the door. She opens the door, and the mom comes in, and she's like, Mom, what are you doing here? And she's like, hey, Kate, I just came to see you. And the other sister's like, hey, don't, like, talk to my sister like that or whatever. And the mom's like, well, you know what? I'm not going to tell you what the mom's like. But there's an interesting twist. And these girls may not be sisters. I really enjoy this, by the way. This is, it's not very deep. It's kind of one of those palate cleanser books. But I dug it. I dug it. I like the art style. And I like when that Archie art style is used in different kinds of stories. Right? So this is kind of a horror book, but it's funny at the same time. It's very funny at the same time. So I dig that kind of thing. I dig that kind of thing. I'm going to give this one a 4 out of 5 as well. Really enjoyed it. Exorcisters number 1 from Image Comics. Final book for today is going to be cover number 2. This is from Jinx World / DC Comics, written by Brian Michael Bendis with art by David Mack. And let's see, who else do we have? Colors by Zhu Orzu and letters by Carlos Mengual. You know, I talked about the first issue, so I wanted to revisit this. And I haven't revisited Pearl yet. That's the one I'm probably going to revisit whenever the next issue comes out. You know what? An issue just came out. I should have revisited it for this episode. That's fine. When issue 4 comes out, I'll revisit Pearl. But this is one of the ones I wanted to revisit because I wasn't quite sure, based on the events of the first issue, how I would feel about what's going on. Pearl was the other one that I felt that way. And I gotta say, even though there's not a lot of additional background material in the second issue, I felt like I learned a lot more about how this world works than I did in the first one, even though the first one set up the premise. And basically we have a comic book artist who, doing his convention circuit, meets this fan who buys a bunch of his art. And it turns out, we learn later on in the book, that she is an NSA agent or a CIA agent, right? She's a spy. And she wants to enlist him to join the agency. And that's kind of where it went, right? And at the end of the book, he finds out that he has been invited to a con in Turkey. So this issue picks up with the con in Turkey, except there's two different narratives going on, because that one narrative, he has been kidnapped and is getting beat up by a guy who's trying to get information from him as to why he's in Turkey. And the other narrative is him actually going to the airport in Turkey, getting picked up by this agent dressed up as a chauffeur, and them having a lot of conversations about what it is that they do, what she expects from him, what she doesn't, whether he wants to do this or not. And the narrative is really interesting, because for being a spy, she is the most happy-go-lucky person in the world, right? She's always smiling. She's always extremely positive. She never really answers directly. And that's one of the things that pisses the guy off. But I love this world that Bendis has set up, where comic book creators are enlisted as spies around the world. Because, I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense in some ways. In some weird way, it makes sense, right? Because they're able to travel and use that as, you know, their cover, hence the name. But, you know, they still meet their fans, they still do their work, but they're able to infiltrate in a certain way that maybe just a spy would not be allowed to, without, you know, having additional, like, stuff done, right? Like a fake story, infiltrating an organization, things like that. So this guy is in Turkey, and, you know, this is kind of pertinent to today because there's a lot of political unrest in Turkey. And, you know, it turns out that the president of Turkey loves this guy's comic. And I can't remember what it's called, like Ninja Samurai something. And so the agency enlists him to give him this little trinket. And it's a locket or a charm that he had created when the series first came out. And they were sold out, right? They weren't being made anymore. They were extremely rare. And they're like, hey, just give us to the president as a gift when he has to meet you, because he's a huge comic fan. So he's going to be at the con. And so he does. And it turns out that it's kind of a bug, right? He's like, oh, like, did I just bug the president? And she's like, oh no, bugs are so 50s. She's like, now it's a 4-dimensional whatever, right? It like maps the entire room and it can listen to sounds and see things like in like x-ray and whatever else. So, obviously, yes, he got played a little bit, but he kind of knows what he's into, right? And that's the thing. He pretends like he doesn't know that he's part of this spy agency now, because technically he isn't, right? He wasn't formally invited. He's not really getting paid, but they're kind of using him in that respect. And it seems like there's other comic creators that are being used by either this agency or others, because one of the guys that's beating him up turns out to also be a comic book creator. And I like that whole narrative as well. I think this book is really quite fascinating. Not something that I expected from Bendis. It really harkens back to, I think, what Bendis was doing before he even got into Marvel, right? When he was doing his indie stuff. And I absolutely love it. I love it. I love it. I really do. I think Cover is a fantastic title. And I hope that's something that you guys are picking up, because you'll be pleasantly surprised. I think the one thing that might hold people back a little bit is the art. And I love David Mack's art. I love all of David Mack's art. But David Mack does some really interesting stuff in this book, and he plays with like 5 or 6 different art styles, right? So there's like the watercolor, there's pencils, there's maybe like charcoal pens. There's a few different art styles that are going on here, and they're all very minimalist, very minimalist. But it works so well here. Even the panels, there's a couple of pages where, like, when the Spy and this comic creator are sitting in a car just talking about the situation. There's not a lot changing, right? Because they're just talking in the car. It's two people talking in a car. But there's something about the way that it's presented, even as simple as it is, that just makes it seem so brilliant. And I don't know what it is, but I loved it. I loved it. I love seeing these changes in the art style throughout the book, in particular when they fit certain parts of the story, right? There's even a little, it's not a flashback, but we see a couple pages from this samurai comic that the guy does, and the events of that story directly relate to what's happening to him in real life. And I thought that was brilliantly done as well. So if you want something new, something different, something that's a little more, man, I would hate to say like pretentious, but I guess in some ways it is. I just think the way this book is put together is absolutely fantastic and really leaves a lot more for the reader to do than the average comic, because you have to fill in a lot of the details yourself as you're reading it. And that's really smart. So cover number 2 is going to be another 5 out of 5. That's going to be the end of this episode. I want to thank you all for listening to this one. You can, of course, find me on Twitter at Geekvine. Email is yell@comictalk.today. And I'll be back probably tomorrow with another episode. I'll catch you then.